Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm Nicholas Gordon, host of the Asian Review of Books podcast, done in collaboration with the New Books Network. In this podcast, we interview fiction and nonfiction authors working in, around, and about the Asia-Pacific region. During the Cultural Revolution, many young urban Chinese were encouraged, if not ordered, to move to the countryside. Millions of young Chinese people in high school and university moved to rural communities ostensibly to receive re-education from the poorest lower and middle peasants to understand what China really is, to quote Mao Zedong at the time. Many students remained in the countryside until the end of the Cultural Revolution almost a decade later. One of these young Chinese people was the mother of Aimé Burrell, who turned these stories into a graphic novel, We Serve the People, My Mother's Stories, published by Arkea last year. The book is roughly split into two halves, her mother's hard work on a rubber plantation in Yunnan, and her struggles a decade later to restart her education upon her return home. Aimé Burrell is a cartoonist and illustrator from Sweden. Her work has also appeared in Adventure Time Comics, Hip Hop Family Tree, Study Group Comics, and a number of publications in Sweden, Denmark, the UK, and Chile. Today, I'll ask Aimé about her mother's story, both during her time in the countryside and when she returned home. We'll talk about what it was like for her to turn these tales into a graphic novel, and what may be gained from expressing them in a visual format. So, Aimé, thank you so much for joining me today on the Asian Review of Books podcast. Perhaps it's best to start with your mother, you know, the main character of We Serve the People. Could you kind of briefly tell us her life story?
Hi, Nicholas. Thanks so much for having me. As I've documented in the book, she was born and raised in Beijing, in China. When she was around 16, the Cultural Revolution started, and that interrupted her studies. She was in seventh grade, I think. She was then kind of, well, definitely against her will, sent down to the south of China, to Yunnan, across the country, which was at that time a three-day train ride to get all the way down to a rubber plantation that she was working on, or working at, is the correct preposition. She was stuck there for around 10 years before she was finally allowed to go back to Beijing, which was what she wanted during all of those years. Like, her main goal was to just get back home. And once back in Beijing, she wanted to continue her studies as they had been interrupted in the middle of her education. She met some people around her did not want her to continue her studies. This was quite a few struggles she had to go through at the time. And basically, because she was then around 30, I think, when she got back to Beijing, there was actually an age limit for how old you can be if you want to enroll in a university. So in China, it was impossible for her to try and get a higher education, an official higher education. She did get a higher degree of some sort, but it wasn't a university degree, which I think she always felt like she lacked. So because of this, she wanted to go abroad where there wasn't an age limit on studying at a higher educational institution. And through family, she got a study visa to go to Sweden and has since remained in Sweden. She still lives there now. And in the end, she did end up working within education. So it's pretty funny how that kind of ended.
So what's happening in China more broadly during this period of time that you talk about in your book, especially for people like your mother?
Well, so at the time, the Cultural Revolution takes off, which means that for people like my mother, basically kids between being in sixth grade until graduating high school, their education is interrupted, or all education is interrupted. So the school is stopped. They don't have any more lectures. All the teachers are held at the schools to kind of be re-educated and think about, you know, the errors they've committed. And everything just comes to a halt, basically. And it stays that way for maybe half a year to a year, where I think she told me she basically just loitered around for a long time. At one point, they were called back to be in school, but there was no education. So they would just, you know, read the newspaper, hear what Mao was saying in the newspapers, and like maybe go visit like the general countryside of the cities, like try and help out in places. I think the army was kind of taking care of the schools, like, you know, making sure everybody was coming in, taking roll call, but then just letting them go about their way. So I think it just, everything kind of grinded to a halt. Everything was in upheaval. And as a kid, it was mostly like, there's no more school.
So obviously kind of the first, say, half of your book talks about your mother going into the countryside to work on this rubber plantation. I wonder if you could share a bit of her experiences, you know, as she related them to you, and then as you relate to us through your book.
Yeah, I feel like, so she's always been telling us stories about her going down to the South and just what happened during the Cultural Revolution when she grew up, since me and my brother were really small. So I feel like I've heard these stories like a million times, but at the same time, I can't remember like all the details of them. But one of the main things that stuck with me was like, and this wasn't until one of our later conversations when I was working on the book, was that she only realized what an irreversible decision it was going down to the countryside when she had finally arrived after that 3-day train journey and feeling such a loss of power and kind of hopelessness, but then deciding that the one thing she had to do was get home. But apart from that, all of her other stories about her time down there aren't so depressing, I would say. Like, they aren't like filled with sadness or anything. They were all pretty matter of fact, just about these small funny stories that happened to her during her time there. Like, one time, I think her and her friends, because it was a really warm summer day, went to a river that was close by the plantation where they worked. And all the old workers at the plantations would tell them, don't go there. It's like dangerous to bathe there. But they were like, it's too warm. Let's go. When they came up, most of them had, what do you call them? Those kind of snails that stick to your body and drink your blood?
Oh, what are leeches? They called?
Yeah, leeches. It was like, the river was filled with leeches, so they all had a bunch of leeches on their bodies and freaked out, obviously. And other like small stories like that. And in between that, just talking about like her day-to-day life, that before she became a truck driver, she was just working on the mountain. They would have to basically cut down the trees and turn the soil on the mountains with like old tools like hatches and hoes. So it was all manual labor because you couldn't like drive a machine up the steep hills. And then you'd have to hand plant all the rubber trees. And then there were different like sections of workers. So some workers would work with the older rubber trees where they would get up super early, like maybe 3 or 4 in the morning, to go up the mountain and set taps to the rubber trees to tap the rubber fluid that comes out of them. And I remember looking into how this works, because when I was writing the book, or like when I was working on it, I was like, I need to get an understanding of how all this works so I can actually like tell other people. but yeah, so it was like quite a bit of just like the day-to-day life during those 10 years, and things that stood out to her, like, oh, that time we jumped in the river and got leeches on us, or that time we got a dog from the military and everybody loved him, so everybody gave like the little ration of meat they would to him. So he got this like beautiful fur, and one day he disappeared. And, yeah. So yeah, a little bit of everything, I would say, but slice of life mostly.
You know, it's interesting because I think, you know, for people who don't necessarily think about the Cultural Revolution very often, I think there's like an image of, you know, that it's this unleashing of youth energy in service of, you know, Mao Zedong's political objectives that eventually went kind of outside of anyone's control and became this huge sprawling thing that was very bad for a lot of people. But of course, your mother doesn't seem to fit in the story, at least as she's expressed it to you. She's not particularly political. But it's also true, I think, at least as the story she's told you, she doesn't necessarily look at this period of being in the countryside. I mean, clearly she wanted to go home, and she was not happy that she was in the countryside, but it's not, it unlike, I guess, perhaps other literature written about this, it's not kind of a list of all of her, all the injustices and trials and tribulations that she went through. I guess, how do you feel that she kind of looks back upon this period of working in Yunnan?
I think, like, it's interesting because, like you say in the beginning, the view of it is that Cultural Revolution, the Red Guard, and the chaos that came with it, which it was. It was 10 years of turmoil and chaos that changed millions of people's lives forever. And all because of it was like a political game to high up politicians. But for, I think her story represents kind of, it's in my eyes, it represents this like powerlessness, but then still fighting your way through it, you know, because there is so, what stands out to me is like there's so little control of what you can do. Everything is decided for you, and all you can do about it is the way you perform the tasks or the way you live your life within this control. And I think it is like that perseverance and that stubbornness and that kind of trying to make your way in a world where you have so little control. That's what I feel her story is about. And I feel like that's probably a lot of people's lives during that time, because there was not really any control by the common person. Like, everything was just going on around you. And I think a lot of people were trying to just keep their heads down to not, you know, end up on the bad side, kind of. That's how I feel her story, like what her story communicates about people.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So one thing We Serve the People does is it kind of continues the story after your mother's time in the countryside. Of course, the whole second half of the book is based on tells us the story of what she does when she comes home and tries to restart her education, tries to figure out what her path in life is after this decade-long disruption. Could you tell us a bit more about that period of her life?
Yeah. So that period, once she got back to Beijing, she felt like a great aimlessness because as all of this youth came back to their home cities, because at the time you couldn't decide what job you would take, or you couldn't choose what job you wanted to do. All you could do was wait around for the government to just place you at a factory or at some kind of workplace and then take that job. But because like millions of young people were coming back at the same time, the state was scrambling to kind of find jobs. And there was just a very long wait for around, I think it was a year, 1.5 years as well. And that's when she thought of trying to kind of make up for lost time. She felt quite a big shame of only being, like having the education level of a seventh grader, but being almost like 30. And she wanted to make up for that. So she started studying by herself, using her older brother's old school books and textbooks, having them to help her, and just trying to make up for all that lost education. And I think that became like one of her big goals in the time after coming back from the countryside, where those 10 years felt like a void to her, like a waste of time, basically. And she was then trying her best to do anything she could to make up for it and get some kind of higher education and a degree. But there were a lot of people who tried to, or there were some people, not a lot of people, but there were some people who tried to like put sticks in the wheels, so to say, because various reasons, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of like there's, it seems to be that her ability to get to continue education is dependent entirely on whether or not various bureaucrats like her or not. You know, obviously the ones that don't like her try to get in her way, but then she has conversations with other bureaucrats who can overrule them and allow her to continue her education.
Yeah, it's that same like loss of control, right? You couldn't decide for yourself what you wanted to do. Everything you wanted to do had to go through your bosses on many levels. Like it had to go through your manager and then the manager's boss and then the entire institution you were working for. And there was this bureaucratic like path you had to go through. And if somebody didn't like you, they could just stop it at any point. And I think in the story, in the second part of the book, the main story, with two of her managers not wanting her to study, she's told me that they felt it was useless studying because why would you want to study when you have no control of your life and that whatever you study doesn't affect the job you get? And then because they had kind of like insinuated this to her, but she had not listened to them, they got like mad or angry at her for not listening and not being respectful of their opinions, basically. Yeah. And I think that's really interesting that for such a small, petty reason, you would like to maybe not ruin somebody's life, but you want to make it way harder.
So I'd like to shift now into talking about your actual process for making the book. Now, I mean, normally, I think on the show we have people working in prose. So it's always like, oh, how did you write the book? What was the process of writing like, etc. But of course, We Serve the People is a graphic novel, so it kind of combines both writing and illustration. So I guess if you could talk a bit more about what it was like to kind of plan out and to write the book and to draw the book as well.
It was really, it was a very long process. It spanned over, maybe 4 years or something like that, because I worked on different parts of the book at different parts of my own education. So I have a degree in graphic storytelling and comics, and I made it's laid up chronologically. The very first 11 pages I made before I started my degree. The like middle chunk of around 40 pages I made in the middle of my degree, and the last chunk of almost 60 pages I made after I had graduated. So it was kind of following me along in my own artistic journey. And
now that you mention it, you're right. The visual style does change as you go through, and I didn't even realize that until you mentioned it just now.
Yeah, it's pretty funny because so the first 11 pages was actually the comic I applied to my degree with. They requested as like an application for my portfolio to apply to my degree was like tell a story in comic format spanning 11 pages to just see if you could produce something that length because it would only get longer and longer. As I studied, and I thought this small story was really interesting and self-contained. And then I pitched those 11 pages to a Swedish book publisher that took me up on the book and gave me a deal for basically the first half of the book. And I made that, it was released in Sweden, and then I was like, I would really like for this book to reach a bigger audience, reach a bigger market. So I took that first half of the book and pitched it to Arkea. And then they liked that, but they were like, it's a little bit too short. Could you please make it longer? And then I tagged along, like I added that final chunk of her time in Beijing and her kind of road to studying and then leaving China in the end. So it was like quite a long process when I think about it. But every time I worked at it, it was very concentrated and small. Like I did the entire last part of the book maybe 3 months. I did the middle part of the book maybe over half a year. And the first part of the book, like... Yeah, that was like over a month or so. So like in concentrated time, it wasn't so long, but in actual time, it spanned over many years, actually. But I think that if I wasn't studying comics, maybe this would have been pure prose. And if I was studying something else, maybe it would have taken a different form. But it was the medium I felt the most fluent in at the time, and it felt like then it was the correct medium to tell the story in. And as I am a very visual person and not necessarily super confident in my writing, it made a lot of sense to let the images speak a lot for themselves as well, even though it's pretty packed with text. But
well, I mean, this may be a bit of a leading question, but what do you think you gain as, well, I guess for you as an author and, you know, also for readers in working in this more visual format?
For me, it was just time to like mull over the things a bit more. And actually a big part of it was really getting familiar with her life at the point. Like all the research led me to find a bunch of photos of how were her living situation at the time. How did the room look? What kind of things did she have? Like, what kind of lights did they use? How was the day-to-day routine? It gave me such a deeper understanding of my mother. So that was really a big part for me. Like, it gave these stories I've heard for so many years another dimension. And I guess that's, now that I'm talking about it, like, I guess that's what it could give the reader as well, because I guess it's that saying, like, a picture says more than 1,000 words, and I wouldn't want to say that my pictures necessarily tell that much, but hopefully, along with the photos I have in the book, it gives the reader a better sense of space and place, and I think we understand things a bit differently when we see them than when we just imagine them, because we're all kind of, you know, locked in our own contexts. And if you've never seen something of a specific thing, how can you imagine it? Because you only have like your own points of reference. And that would maybe make it skew it or distort it. So hopefully this can give a like more rounded image of how life was at that point.
So I have, I think, one more question about the book. And it's actually something that's only implied in the book. So in that very first section, the 11 pages, which you submitted, I think, is way back when you were applying for degree programs, it's a story about your mother as she's a truck driver. She's asked to bring along a few drivers who are stuck, who missed the bus. One of the drivers is this very celebrated worker, works hard. So she drives them to where they need to go. The truck gets stuck. Someone else comes along and pulls them out. And then the story kind of ends there, except the punchline of the story is your mother says, "And I never met that driver again for 40 years, and then turns to the man next to her on the couch and goes, "Isn't that right?" And so you don't tell the rest of the story as to how your mother and this driver kind of reconnected after 40 years. So I have to ask, what happened?
Well, it's kind of funny. So in that story, it might seem like it's implying that they are my parents, but he's actually my stepdad. And that also explains like the vast amount of time that passes in between. So they only met in that kind of long journey between Kunming and the plantation, which was a 3 or 4 day journey, I think. And she was aware of him, he was aware of her afterwards, and then they never really spoke again at the plantation during the time they were there. Maybe they would nod hello or anything or something like that, but nothing more. And then she went back to Beijing, he went back to his hometown, she went through the rest of what's in the book, and then she left for Sweden, where she met my dad, had me and my brother, and they stayed together for a really long time until, in the end, it didn't work out, so they got a divorce. And at that point, I think one of her friends from this time, because it was like those university years but spent on a plantation, right? So it was some of her closest friends, like that was her crew, so to say. They told her, you remember that guy you went on that long drive with? He's still not married. So they did this like matchmaking thing for her and was like, you should really get in touch with him. You should really, here's his telephone number. Let's call him, you know? And so I guess she was at a point where she's like, yeah, nothing to lose. He seemed like an okay guy. Why not? And she gave him a call and they just hit it off because, as I remember, she would be on the phone for hours, hours and hours and hours just talking to him. And I think they decided over the phone, let's get married without even having met each other, which I find like, wow, that's insane. but it's still, I mean, it worked out. She flew to like meet him and get married, and then he moved to Sweden. And now he lives with her in Sweden, and they have a great time. So I think that was like one of the stories she told me after they had gotten married. I don't ever remember her telling that story like back when she was together with my dad still. but probably like I bet me or my brother would have asked like, well, how did you even know him? And then the story kind of came out. So that's what happened.
well, that clarifies. I mean, that explains a lot. Because again, I kind of read that bit, and I was like, wait, what? And then you just kind of move on. It's like, no, wait, what? How did this happen? But it really sounds like that, especially in our conversation, you've kind of mentioned stories that are not part of the book, because I mean, obviously you have to kind of pick and choose what goes in there, and it really sounds like there really were a wealth of stories shared by your mother about this time.
Yeah, there's so many more, honestly, and I would have loved to put more in there. But it didn't really fit this like the journey of this book. And in my mind, I still turn around like, oh, it would be nice to make another one with more of the other stories. Because as you say, there's just so many. And apart from that, I find the way my grandparents lived and their lives also to be super fascinating and interesting. And I would love to do something with that in the future as well. But yeah, that is, time will tell if I will get a chance and have the time to revisit that, either like, officially in like a book form, or who knows, maybe in a web comic form or in a zine form. It's just, I find like human real stories super interesting because most of the time they are, like people say, stranger than fiction, because life just throws you around and then you have to like try and flail and keep yourself afloat somehow. And I just find it so interesting how people do stay afloat and how people survive.
So with that, thank you for listening to our interview with M.A. Burrell, author of We Serve the People, My Mother's Stories. One actual last question. M.A., what's next for you, and where can people find your work?
Well, currently I'm working on a small children's book. I've been wanting to work with something with less text and more images for quite a while, but that's still in the making. And in the back of my mind, I'm turning around some more of these stories, some more of other stories that I would love for them to see the light of day as comics sometime in the future. But in the meantime, while you can find my work on Instagram, under my handle is just MA Burrell as it is, or you can reach out to me on Twitter if you want to know some more. Just DM me. It's the same handle, MA Burrell. And I think that's where those are the only platforms I'm on. But you can see some of the art I put up there if you want.
So you can follow me, Nicholas Gordon, on Twitter at NickRIGordon. That's NickRIGordon. You can go to AsianReviewOfBooks.com to find other reviews, essays, interviews, and excerpts. Follow on Facebook or on Twitter at BookReviewsAsia. That's reviews plural. And you can find countless other author interviews at the New Books Network at NewBooksNetwork.com. The Asian Review of Books podcast is on all your favorite podcast apps, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. If you subscribe, continue listening to us, rate us, recommend us, share us with your friends. If you want to support us continuing to interview those writing in, around, and about Asia. Next week, join us for an interview with Catherine Menon, author of Fragile Monsters. But before then, thank you so much, Amei, for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me.